This episode of The Tome is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you to our patrons at patreon.com/thetomeshow. Welcome to The Tome, a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we're going to draw a card and hope it doesn't ruin the whole podcast as we discuss the Book of Many Things, Part 1.
For the first person joining us in this episode, we drew the Sage. We're going to ask a question that no one else can answer and gain an invaluable wisdom. He comes at us from the far-off realm of Thaco with advantage. It's the Sage himself, Jared Rasher.
Wow, I was not expecting the Sage reference going to me. I really thought that was going to be your other guest.
Then you'll be really surprised that for the second guest, we have drawn the Knight card. Summoning a mighty warrior to stand by our side and protect us from the evils of the world. Coming from Tribality and Edition Wars, it's the Tome Show's most skilled fighter, Branda Stoddard.
Hey, thanks. I was sure I was drawing the Fool.
I just find it ironic that I didn't go Knight with Jared, because that is a...
Yeah. It's right there. His deal.
It's kind of his deal. But I like to be contrarian.
And yes, you'd be the jester then.
probably.
So we're here to talk about the Book of Many Things. This book is a bit of a collection of a bunch of different things, almost like a deck of many things themed magazine articles. There's such a broad range of things that we decided this would be a good opportunity to do a new format for the show. Rather than a one episode look at a new product, we're going to record episodes more often, but we're going to go in a deeper dive into a handful of chapters for each episode. For this episode, we'll do an introduction and start at chapter one and see how far we get. To start off, it's disclosure time. Who's working from review copies besides me?
I am.
I am.
I'm not.
Jared pays good hard money for his books.
Earning my own money every time.
Way to go. I'm proud of you, man. All right. So let's start off, as I oftentimes do, and ask the question, what is this book? Because honestly, this book needs that question to be asked more than many.
Well, Jeff, clearly it's the Book of Many Things.
Right.
Many things. It's a lot of things.
It's a lot of things.
So, like with adventures especially, we've seen them do these kind of compendium books. You know, it's what I wrote on with Candlekeep Mysteries, right? There's a bunch of different writers and different voices coming together in the book, right? And this is not a large number of writers. It's a lot of in-house writing, plus I think there might be maybe one name on there I don't recognize as working for WotC already, but I could be wrong about that too, because who knows these days.
That's a whole other conversation.
Well, right. they're sort of letting each chapter do its own completely different thing. And that completely different thing might overlap with other chapters around it or not, as long as it's themed around that card.
The old school reader of things D&D in me wants to compare this to Dragon Magazine in a lot of ways, except that each chapter is like a mini issue of the magazine. And for each chapter, you get like two or three articles. And each issue is themed around one of the, 22 original cards for the Deck of Many Things. And so you end up with an eclectic mix of stuff, right? I felt, if anything, the first two chapters, and I think we'll at least get through those two chapters tonight. I feel like the first two chapters were pretty thematically tied together. And then in chapter three, like the Deck of Many Things theme is still strong in chapter three, but it starts to broaden.
They're telling a lot of separate stories here. right?
Mm-hmm.
And each chapter is going to kind of cover its own range of things. It's not, even each chapter is not laser focused on one thing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I said on social media after my first sort of flip through of the book is that this book is not the best reference book. If you want to find a thing at the table, this is going to be a frustrating book for that, because there are spells, different new spells featured in 10 different places. And so figuring out where that one spell is that you want is going to be frustrating if you're not a D&D Beyond person who can just do a quick search. But boy, at least so far digging into it, it's a fun read. And I think there's going to be like little elements of like, oh, I'm going to use that idea. And I'll just sort of log which ideas I'm using at my table and just sort of have those pages handy. And in that regard, it comes together okay.
And it does give you all of the monsters together in a single table toward the end of the book for a little bit more ease of searching. Right.
And we've been talking about the book and the contents of the book, but also there is a deck of many things.
Right.
There's also a deck and a book for the deck.
Yes. I was going to ask about that. So there is also, if you buy the physical product and not just the D&D Beyond book, right, there is an actual, like it's a box, and the box is bigger than the book. And it's it has three slots in it, each with a bunch of cards, and they're nice cards. They're like gold
foil, they're gorgeous.
Edges, yep. And the art is like, it's a not quite two-toned art. It's like every card has this art that is two-toned, but then with like a really subtle accent color in a lot of cases, or sometimes very poignant accent color. It's absolutely like the deck is really cool. And then there's this like hardcover book inside it with that. That's sort of and here's a bunch of ways to interpret the cards and to lay them out to mean different things. And it's funny because I kind of looked at that, at the deck and that book a little bit right after I had read chapter 3 in preparation for tonight. And there's like chapter 3 has like, here are some different things you can do with the deck. And I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't even know if we'll get to it tonight, but like, there's a lot of that is an overlap or sending the same message as what this book inside of the deck is doing. And like, this is how you can use it to represent a journey or a quest or an encounter or whatever. And so it almost feels like, hey, here's a bunch of cohesive themed things that make sense to help you interpret the deck that didn't make it into the actual big book.
I actually wanted to touch on another product that came out, was it last year or the year before that? The Dungeons and Dragons tarot deck that came out, because I've heard people comparing these, because there is that same, you know, there's a book in there that kind of tells you how to do a tarot spread to, you know, figure out an adventure or things like that. And I've heard people say this was better, but I think what I missed in a lot of that conversation is the Dungeons and Dragons tarot deck was not done by WotC. It was licensed as an official deck.
Are you talking about the tarot deck or the Taroka deck that they put out with Strahd?
No, there's literally a tarot deck that came out.
Because they also did the Taroka deck in two different versions. Because there's the original small version, which I'm, for the four of us who can see the video, I'm holding up, which are just the size of normal playing cards. But then they also did a more like tarot deck type version that I think came with the big fancy Curse of Strahd coffin box.
Yeah, I have that behind me.
It's around the corner, yeah. Which, ironically, I bought the Curse of Strahd coffin box after I finished running Curse of Strahd, but it's kind of cool and I wanted to see what was in it.
Of course.
Anyway, so, yeah. So the cards.
Yeah, so I mean, but what I was saying is a lot of the discussion around the D&D tarot cards seem to be that they weren't up to the quality that people were. Not the artwork looks fine, the cards are fine, but the interpretation book that was written wasn't, you know, enough to thrill a lot of people. But it's one of those things that I always worry about. Like, it has the Dungeons and Dragons name on it, but it was not produced by WotC. And it's like this book that we're talking about and these cards are produced by the Dungeons and Dragons team.
Right. And that's, I mean, that's been a problem going back to the OGL with third edition, right? Is that third edition had this issue of, look at all these third party publishers putting the D&D name on it, on their products, but D&D has no control over it. And then they overcompensated with the GSL in fourth edition. So,
yeah.
Open gaming continues to be a struggle for WotC.
Well, I mean, it's the tarot deck is officially licensed. It's just, right. It wasn't done by them.
And you would think if they were going to officially license it, they'd want to at least take a look at it first, but.
I mean, I'm not saying that they didn't, but it wasn't done by the D&D team. So,
right.
The other thing I wanted to touch on before we move too far away from the cards is, because I like burning lots of money that I shouldn't. I also have the Roll20 version, and what's interesting about that is there is a deck, and if you have anything Roll20 that has cards in it, you know there's like a virtual deck that you can deal cards out of, but the deck that they include in the Roll20 version is just the 22 standard cards, not the new ones that they've added, and I was kind of disappointed in that.
Yeah. What's up with that? People should look out for that then.
Well, especially because the Taroka deck, if you get it through Roll20, they have options to add the high deck, the common deck, or the whole deck. So it's so they have that, you know, and I kind of wish that they would have had all of the cards that they introduced in this book in the Roll20 version of it. But again, the Roll20 implementation is not directly WotC, so I just wanted to throw that out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Hmm. So I think... I definitely wanted to talk about the existence of the physical product and the cards and all that kind of stuff tonight. But I also think the book, the interpretation book itself, deserves a deeper dive like each chapter does. But I think I want to save it for the end, mostly because I have not done a deep reading yet. So, and it makes sense to either do it at the beginning or the end, and I'm not ready to do it at the beginning, so...
Yeah, and it definitely is, because at first you guys were just talking about we're going to cover the book, and I was like, okay, wait, I want to make sure I've picked the right book.
Right.
Could you be more specific?
Yes. Fair
enough. I will just say that, like, my wife Rabbit has spent a lot of time doing tarot readings and knows, like, traditional Rider-Waite tarot and similar systems very, very well. I feel like she might have some really interesting stuff to say when you get to the interpretation book.
Okay.
In addition to, she's loved the deck of many things for her entire D&D playing career,
right,
which is more extensive than mine.
We have talked about, for this format, of the four of us as sort of the stable... for each episode, going through each chapter bit by bit, and having like a fifth rotating guest that comes in for each episode, which would have been brilliant. And today's guest was supposed to be our very own Sam Dillon, who co-hosts Edition Wars with Brandis and knows the history of the game pretty well. And that is relevant to, I think the first chapter talks about the history. Yeah. And then he got himself a case of the COVID and is not feeling up to recording tonight, so we're giving him the break. But when you had mentioned Rabbit coming on and joining us, my first thought was, oh, great. I don't have to hunt for our guest in 2 weeks when we do the next recording, right?
Because the goal is to be separate for the week. That's right. But whatever, you know.
But if she wants to be in for the interpretation and we're doing that at the end, although we could always have her on twice, right? Rabbit is lovely and good to talk to. The trick has always been, can we get both Brandis and Rabbit at the same time? And so far, the answer has been no, because you have children.
The answer is also no, because microphones.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean,
you could sit in the same room, and I guess you have a headset mic, don't you?
Right.
Okay.
It's really tough when we're on calls together, which we are all the time.
Yeah.
Well, we were a little far afield of this topic, though.
Maybe the Tome Show should spend some of our Patreon money and buy you another microphone so we could have both of you on sometime.
Twist my arm.
All right. Let's talk about chapter one.
Do it.
Chapter one is interesting to me in as much as, in some ways, it is your traditional introductory chapter to a book, right? It's got the how do you use this book section in it? How do you read a stat block? How do you read box text or whatever, right? But it's still, they didn't do it as an introduction. It's still themed around the Deck of Many Things. And so chapter one is The Fool. And I'm curious how to interpret that. To take your introduction and call it The Fool, does that mean that we are a fool for even diving into the Deck of Many Things? Is that the judgment they're making?
No, it means that The Fool is the first card in the Rider-Waite Tarot.
Fine.
Hey.
I'm trying to be interpretive here.
I'm just saying, this is, like, I think there's a point to be made in the fact that this and the classic tarot start on the same card.
Hmm. I mean, that's not right. That's true. But it also means that it is the only one of the chapters where the content of the chapter isn't really thematically tied to the card.
Right. So the theme of The Fool is about the beginning of the journey into wisdom.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I just don't understand what the cards mean then.
Well, that's I'm telling you.
I appreciate that.
It's fine not to know, right? But like that's the whole story of the major arcana of the traditional tarot, right? You have to start without wisdom to complete this path of wisdom. And growth.
So the being the fool is not a judgment of your idiocy, right, so much as it is you are a fool because you are at the beginning of your journey and you will become wise over time.
Yeah. Judgment is a later card.
Sure. Fair enough.
This is why Brandis should have been the sage. I'm just saying.
He's protecting us from my bad opinions.
Mm.
So the first section of chapter one is really just an introduction to the book and what it is and what the Deck of Many Things is. I don't think there's anything super controversial or worthy of deep conversation going on there.
I love that they give a history of the Deck of Many Things, edition over edition. I mean, as I'm also visiting from Edition Wars.
Yes.
That's great to see, you know?
Yeah, no. So I'm referencing the D&D Beyond version of the book. So every time I have to swipe left or right, I'm considering it a new section. And the deck in D&D is like section two. And that's why I hadn't mentioned that yet. But that's
That's
a piece that I really enjoy. And they talk, I mean, they go back to 1975, the first appearance of the deck. And they talk about how the deck has evolved and changed, like throughout the editions, through Dungeon and Dragon Magazine, Madness of Gardmore Abbey, and then into fifth edition. And they talk about how not only has the deck changed, but the number of cards have changed, the interpretation, the meaning of the mechanical effect of those cards have changed. And they also talk at the very end of it how also we've changed the names of a few cards because they didn't have the best name for everybody. So they changed the name of the idiot to the puzzle because it's all about sort of puzzles and riddles and traps and that kind of stuff, which makes sense. And they changed the vizier to the sage, which has a similar connotation to what it always was, but it's less culturally appropriated, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So,
any additional thoughts on the history section?
I'm really happy that the Tarot Deck of Many Things gets name checked here. I have the Encyclopedia Magica 4-volume set on off my shelf just out of reach, but I remember when I first bought those, my absolute favorite item in all 4 books put together was the Tarot Deck of Many Things, because it took, you know, the Deck of Many Things from my second ed DMG, right, which I loved, and then expanded that to a staggering 78 card deck with upright and reversed meanings. Like, what is happening? There are so many cards.
Yeah, that feels very second edition.
Well, it was it's a Dragon Magazine article,
yeah,
right? But I never would have seen that because I didn't collect Dragon Magazine at the time. And when I did start collecting Dragon Magazine, it was much too late for issue number 77.
Yes.
I came along later than that. But
I was, however, old enough.
The Encyclopedia Magica was a great, great book release for that kind of thing. Sorry, Jared, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I was old enough to have Dragon Magazine 148, however, which is the one that had the pullout section with the Deck of Many Things, and I had that deck for a long time, and it made you want to introduce that deck into a campaign.
Yeah, let chaos reign, I guess.
I was, in my day, a big fan of every campaign has to have an appearance by the Deck of Many Things at some point, and every campaign has to have a Wand of Wonder in it, you know.
Apparently,
I'm a sucker for the chaos. Now, the trick with the Deck of Many Things is, like, it might show up, and people may be like, nope, I'm good, and then it doesn't matter, and that's fine. Other than the campaign I ran that was Madness at Gardmore Abbey, right? That one, you have to interact with the deck there. But
I will say, if you buy an actual physical deck of many things and put it in the middle of the table, your players are that much more likely to go against their better interest and decide to pull from.
Yeah. No, back in my like high school, college days, I never had an actual like deck of many things. But I pulled all the playing card cards I needed out of a playing card deck to form a deck of many things that I just sort of kept with all my D&D stuff just in case it came up. So I ruined a deck of playing cards in order to carry around a deck of many things.
And for me, it was interesting because I started playing with 4th, and like you did eventually get deck of many things with Madison Gardmore Abbey. But I had never, like, I didn't really do that one because I didn't play, we didn't run, I was a DM, so I didn't run adventures and stuff. So I didn't really have that experience, that I did not have the history, but I did know from the other players in our group that how storied and, I don't know how to put it, like, want it but don't want it thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think storied is about as good of a word as we can get in D&D, right? Like, you could just look at it and think, well, that's running campaigns. Woo, buddy!
or not, and you have no idea. Because it all depends on how many cards they're going to take and what cards they get.
Well, right, but like, oh, one player jumped 50,000 experience points ahead. That's cool. All right.
so much for milestone leveling, huh?
Definitely milestone leveling can get wrecked with the deck.
I will say, the more I read references to Madness at Gardmore Alley, the more I am sad that that was like the only edition that I have been present for that I did not DM. I only played. And that kind of makes me want to dig into that one.
I really enjoyed Madness of Gardmore Abbey, running that one. It was actually the last 4th edition campaign I ran, and it was like a little mini campaign. It was only covered a handful of levels, but it actually ended with my party. Like, they successfully collected all the cards and reformed the deck, and then somebody attacked them and stole it from them. and they lost the deck. And that was sort of my in-world explanation of, and now chaos reigns throughout the world and physics itself is changing. And thus we are doing the playtest that is eventually going to be fifth edition and everything is all over the place, right? The rules keep changing. And the deck of many things was the explanation for why the rules kept changing. So I really liked that they acknowledged Gardmore Abbey. In fact, there's a decent write-up for the fourth edition section. There's a lot of, you know, I'm always concerned with the stigma that fourth edition has and the controversy that surrounds it a bit, that it's going to be sort of, oh, no, like we'll acknowledge it, but we're going to kind of tuck it to the side. They not only embraced it here, but I like that it continues the ideas from Gardmore Abbey will show up again later in even mm-hmm. the sections that we read for tonight, in the idea that like you can separate the deck and pull an individual and find an individual card. And there's a mechanical magical impact of that individual card has, which is totally a thing that came from Gardmore Abbey. So far as I know,
I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but in the time since 2014, when they were releasing fifth edition and not knowing who was going to be buying it, so they were trying to appeal to certain people that didn't buy the previous edition, they really avoided a lot of connections with fourth edition. I believe that over the intervening decade, and knowing that literally now there are more people playing D&D that have never touched another edition of D&D, they are a lot more likely to acknowledge that as part of the history of the game, because it's not part of the marketing strategy to say, look, we're not that anymore.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So any other thoughts on the history section, Brandis?
I was just going to say, like, I have referenced the deck of many things once in one of my current campaigns. The PCs were exploring a ruined part of Castle Neverember, and they found just a part of the ruin card, the rest of it having been burned away when the card got turned and used. Mm-hmm. That was the whole appearance of the deck so far. If there'll be more, I don't know yet. I guess we'll see.
That's interesting. So because I got to see Rabbit's animated deck of many things at Gen Con, the year that I met Brandis and Rabbit at Gen Con, I ordered my own copy of it and subsequently used it in one of my games.
Very nice. Very
and
nice.
Chaos ensued. Originally, because of the Midgard game, I had the Shadow Fae messing with the deck of many things to power other, you know, random chaotic effects. And so the party eventually collected a deck, and then the Paladin of Thor quickly got his soul separated from his body.
As will happen.
Yep.
So let's move on to the next section, which is really just a breakdown of the chapters. I don't know that we need to go through the whole breakdown of the chapters, because we're going to go through and break down all the chapters. Then, if I my page will turn, there's the using the book section. We know how to read a D&D book at this point, I hope. Which takes us to chapter 2 already. The key. I keep putting a the in it. It's just chapter 2, key. Chapter 1, fool. So what, Brandis? You're going to protect me from bad interpretations and opinions. How should I interpret key, the key card?
Well, I don't know for sure. That isn't the next card in the Rider-Waite Tarot. Okay. Nor am I an expert in the Rider-Waite Tarot. I just know a few things. However, I think that if you were starting out on some kind of journey, a key is a nice thing to have, especially if you don't know how to open the door in front of you.
Mm. And that's really, as I'm flipping through the sections, this is a chapter where they give us an opportunity to, like, let's talk about the deck of many things and how to, let's say, unlock its potential in your campaign, how to prep for it, how to implement, you know, to integrate it. And it kind of starts off with an origin story, because through the storied history of the Deck of Many Things, there have been many tales told about how it was created. In this case, I believe they acknowledge those previous stories and then create a whole new origin story never before heard. Is that accurate? Is this all completely new?
This is completely new. And it's fascinating for them to even choose to engage with canonicity as a concept, right? Within their multiverse, but I mean, they want to introduce this character of Asteria, and they want to get into, you know, who Uriel is, and
is that how we're going to pronounce that?
I pronounce it.
Okay.
Man, if anybody else knows better, they should tell me, but that's what it looks like to me.
I don't know. I almost feel like there's a Greekness to the name, so maybe
there is,
so
yeah.
Maybe it pronounce is, yeah. The final E, Uriale, or is, I don't know. I'm not, I don't speak Greek either.
I too am a barbarian. I am so, looking up.
What was the intro?
Oh, Uriale? Here we go.
Okay.
Uriale. According to Google right now, is that reliable anymore? I don't know.
So we have.
And we'll have to say that about 1,000 times before I get used to it now.
Right. And we have that character, and that character, as I recall, was a name of the card. There has been a card with that name going back some time, without really any explanation as to what that name was, or at least I never not knew what the reference was.
I mean, it's associated with the Greek mythology version of a Gorgon,
yep,
which is who that character is in Greek mythology. Okay. So there's a reason for it, although it is funny that, you know, D&D has really leaned hard on just calling them Medusas, which was a different sister.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And then, Asteria and Uriale, or however we're going to say it. And then they also introduced, so far as I can tell, a new god of fate, Istus.
Oh, no. No. Oh, is Istus has been around for a long time in Greyhawk.
Oh, it's Greyhawk.
Yes, Istus was the reason that second edition happened in Greyhawk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, my second edition didn't, so tell me more.
there is a collection of adventures called Fate of Istus, where Istus is challenging all the different character classes to see which ones get to survive going forward into the future of Greyhawk.
Oh, wow.
And it so happens that, you know, Istus decided that monks didn't need to exist anymore and cavaliers didn't need to exist anymore, etc. But yeah, it was an adventure anthology that moved from first to second edition.
How incredibly meta of a story that
yeah.
is. whereas the Forgotten Realms explained that through the Time of Troubles and oops, Ball died, so no more assassins.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's only slightly less meta.
Yeah, right.
And in fairness, the sudden head fake of no, I have to keep Artemis and Treri.
Right.
He was a fighter all along. Oh, come on.
He's a fighter rogue who happens to kill people for a living. He's not an assassin.
God. Assassin small A. Small A.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm just going to say, is Perforce the antithesis of wheel, Jared? Just for you, bud.
So we get this story introducing these characters, one of which has a card named after them and another of which is on the cover of the book. But I don't think Asteria has a card named after her, does she?
No.
Okay. But they wanted a
new character.
Right, Uriale has been the name of this card since forever, and they wanted to actually drill down to who that is to them, and, you know, how she isn't, in fact, just the villain at the center of the piece. She's not. And sort of the way the story goes definitely reminds me of Uncaged in a good way.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always a little bit when fifth edition comes along and invents wholly new canonical origin stories for things, and this is not the first time they've done it. I'm torn because on one hand, like, I don't know the deep lore for the origin story of everything in D&D through every edition, right? That's why I have edition wars to listen to. But
sure.
So I don't mind, like, okay, great, we can start fresh, and this is the new canon, and honestly, this is the canon for most people who play D&D because fifth edition has so much more people playing D&D than ever before. Great. We're all on the same page now, no problem. But there's also, like, fifth edition has had a long history of paying homage to and honoring the previous editions and the canon and the lore from those previous editions. And sometimes bringing so much so that they bring in Greyhawk lore and stick it in the Forgotten Realms or whatever. Right. And it's like, there is story that existed. There is origins that existed. And could they have just reworked one of those to make something that was just as workable and just as sort of as a common touch point at this point. And so I'm curious what other people think about that, creating all new origin story or leaning on a revision of an older one.
I really love this new story and don't. And it's not because it's bad. I actually really like it. I like a lot of the multiversal lore that they've been, you know, threading throughout, like, Fizzbands and Bigby's and now this. I really do wish they hadn't used Istus, because it feels really weird for the goddess of fate on one D&D world to create this thing that is
everywhere,
a major thing everywhere. And if you're going to use a god that is going to kind of overwrite the entire, you know, D&D multiverse, I would rather it be one from, like, the fourth edition pantheon, which was a lot broader and more generally not associated with just one setting.
Fair. Sort of, like, honestly, a god from Greyhawk matters so little to me, because sort of that's any setting that I'm not currently playing.
I played so much third edition, and third edition assumed Greyhawk as the default.
Right.
In the corporate way. So I'm right. Used to that as being default generic gods now.
Right. Well, the Greyhawk gods were the default, but it was a really narrow slice of the overall Greyhawk pantheon.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, like, if it's not specifically from Forgotten Realms or Birthright or Kryn, I probably don't know it.
Right.
And so, like, it is just as good as fully new for my experience.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Sam is mad right now, doesn't even know why.
Yeah. if they did pull from the fourth edition gods, that's the Nintir Vale pantheon, which largely borrowed from Greyhawk as well. But the god of...
Sort of,
The god of
fate. They borrowed from everything. Bane's in there too.
That's true.
Yep.
The god of fate for that, at least in the modern interpretation of this goddess, would be the Raven Queen, which is a weird feel.
Or if you wanted to make it randomness, it could be Vondra.
Yeah.
The Raven Queen also would have been a weird choice because, fifth edition products have already drilled into her history to some degree, right? Mordenkainen's Tome of Foes, I think.
Okay.
I think it's a deep dive into her history, which does not maybe coexist all entirely peacefully with her fourth edition history, but
no,
we're getting a little off.
It's true. The two of them are different enough that I had to, for my game, because my last campaign that I sent into Avernus game dealt heavily with her. I had to create an amalgam version of the Raven Queen that worked pretty well for me, in that I got to play with the things that were new with her, but my players who didn't play fourth edition, but know her from Critical Role, got to still have sort of those touchstones that, that all
right. felt true. That's a big thing in my Tuesday night game that I play in. We're dealing a lot with the creation of the Raven Queen as a goddess. That was
kind of an underlying theme in my campaign too. We should compare
notes.
Next time I need a sub for behind the DM screen, we'll have to get together and talk about Raven Queen.
Well, I am PCing this, not running it. So you will get to hear what our GM is doing.
So I should invite them on as a sub. I don't know who your GM is, but
yeah, we'll talk about it. He might say yes to that.
Okay. All right. Should we move on to the next section? Unsurprisingly, chapters 1 and 2 are the most straightforward and simple for us to go through. And I don't know that we're going to get through to chapter 3 because we're already 47.
We'll see.
So we'll see how it goes. The next section is the preparing to use the deck section. I find it interesting. They talk about, this is where they first introduced the idea of customizing your deck. Taking your deck and taking some cards out, putting some cards in. And this is a piece of advice that they put so far, at least in my reading, it comes up over and over and over again.
Yep.
I kind of get the impression that this book came from all of these people complaining on the internet about how the deck of many things is a campaign destroyer, so never use it. And them saying, now, hold on. Let's write a whole book to tell you why, and in fact, you can use it. And one of the big things is if there's something that's going to ruin your campaign, just pull that card out.
And right. Coming soon, booster decks where you can.
Don't even start that conspiracy theory. The tin hats are out in force.
Maybe it's an in world booster decks. Istis is selling booster decks. If you want to,
oh, add for God's sake. Worlds.
Fortune cards from 4E, right? So
yeah. Oh man, people are so mad.
Now I do really like the customizing your deck section and the because they get into specific types of decks that you can build and tell you exactly what cards to put in them. Right? They have their starter
deck. Yeah, I like that.
You know, if you want cards that are going to focus on role playing, if you want the lighthearted, the deck of horror, right? They specifically tell you put these cards in, leave those cards out. That's how you build the starter deck that you can run at level one.
I think that's a great approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of times a book will do something like, hey, do this thing, but it doesn't follow through with really granular examples. And I love that they followed through with multiple decks and explaining why you would use that particular deck.
Yeah.
Yep.
No. And in fact, this is the part of reading through this book that I started thinking, oh, the deck of many things could absolutely fit well into my next campaign, which is, I'm running Witchlight next. And there's a sort of fey randomness whimsy to the deck that could actually really fit well. I'm looking around as my players might be in the room. If you're my player and you're listening, shut your ears for a second. But I'm going to add an element to Witchlight where Zabilna's absence or frozenness is allowing the Far Realm to invade. And so I could continuously use the deck like they're going to talk about in the next chapter or the next section for like determining encounters or things they run into or sources of inspiration. And slowly, as the campaign goes on, sneaking more and more of the horrific things in there to represent the influence of the Far Realm increasing over time.
Which nice.
Could work really well.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And to tie, because when it said, here's a starter set that you could run from level one, and here's a role-playing focus set that my players are going to, or lighthearted, like these are all things that fit well into Witchlight to the point that I'm like, oh, what if, I'm already planning to run this adventure that runs them through the carnival as kids when their lost thing gets stolen. And then they build their characters after that session. What if part of that session zero we're running as kids campaign involved them pulling a card from a fortune teller at the carnival, who, and then they each get a card and then I make note of that card and they don't get the benefit of that card until they recover their lost thing. And so I'm already, let's see, I'm reading through this and I'm already starting to churn all these ideas about how this could very well work into a campaign that I am going to start running at some point between a week from now and a month from now.
Nice. So,
there's also a section under that about the deck as narrative. And they use the big advice there is just because you pulled a card from the deck doesn't mean the thing has to happen now, right? It could be the card is making something happen more naturally in the world. It could be you pulled the knight card. Well, instead of just immediately summoning a knight that swears fealty to you, it means that the DM is going to integrate a story soon where you rescue a knight and they join you to pay off their life debt or whatever.
Yep.
One of the things that this immediately had me thinking was if you have someone pull a very bad card, it is a great story beat to maybe let them know what would trigger that card happening and what they need to do to keep the card from triggering. And all of a sudden you have some built-in tension there. It's not just an immediate, you know, someone in your campaign just disappeared.
Well, even if it's not like there's a thing that's going to trigger it, and you know, but the idea that you pull a card and it's going to happen to you and it's going to happen to you eventually. And there's this sort of Damocles and you don't know when it's going to fall.
I absolutely imagine a do it to Julia kind of moment there of just, nope, that thing is too horrible. I am going to find a different victim for my card. I think of myself as a hero, but I can't.
Absolutely. And it's the one advice I have for this section. Like, I really like this advice. The addendum I would add is people are aware of how the deck of many things is supposed to work or has traditionally worked. So if you're going to go this route with it, I would let the players know before they start drawing cards from the deck. Just so there's not like, hey, this is supposed to summon a pile of gems for me. Why isn't the pile of gems showing up? Okay, and then they feel like they're being cheated. Now I have to work for the reward that I was supposed to get for pulling the card and taking that risk. So I would at least be upfront with
them. Yeah, I guess people could feel that way about it. Right.
So I would just let people know there's going to be delayed gratification on these cards.
Right.
So,
isn't it if you're using it narratively, like you're specifically, you're not using it as, like, they do talk about, and we might not have hit it yet, that it's only when you pull it intending for it to have its effects and you say how many cards you're going to pull, that you're actually using it the way that, like that.
They do talk about that later. That might be in the next section.
Yeah.
That was actually, way back in that Dragon Magazine article that had the pullout section, they went into a lot of that back then, even. Like, you have to intentionally pull this and, you know, follow the form. It's not just an accidental, you know, oops, I tripped over a card.
Yeah.
That might be two sections later when they talk about the deck in play. It feels like where that would be.
Yeah.
And so we're getting ahead of ourselves, but there is a mechanic wherein the deck only has the effect of the deck of many things if you pull a card knowing how the deck works and doing it intentionally and saying, I'm going to pull X number of cards and then doing it. That way you can still have the deck with a fortune teller who's playing out the cards of the deck and then not like banishing themselves or summoning a minor death avatar or whatever every time they do somebody's reading.
That's probably just as well.
What's that?
That's probably just as well.
Sure. So, okay, so we talked about preparing the deck. The next section is introducing the deck. And it's just a short little section where they talk about how to bring the deck into your game. And they give a few examples. Somebody could give them the deck. They talk about specifically these mischievous fae called Rifflers who like to sort of seed the deck around the planes in order to sow chaos. You know, they talk about you could bring in Gardmore Abbey, and I like that they've continued the timeline of Gardmore Abbey, right? Clearly the Gardmore Abbey that they reference is the Gardmore Abbey after the campaign, Madness of Gardmore Abbey, because that one had whole different threats. Now all of a sudden, like, all of those threats are gone, and there's just a big red dragon that lives in the ruins of Gardmore Abbey and has the deck of many things, right? And then they talk about how there's a fortune teller that in a fairy market that can bring it in. And it's interesting to me that they, like, these early chapters especially, and I imagine it's going to tail off pretty quick, but in these early chapters, there's a lot of, like, you know, it could be this. Go to this chapter and learn more about, you know, it could be the fortune teller at the fairy market. Go to chapter 14 to learn about Ottlewin. You know, it could be Gardmore Abbey. Go to chapter 16 to learn more about Gardmore Abbey. You know, and so there's a lot of, like, there are sections of it that are like, we're going to give you some interesting advice or an introduction to how to do some things, even though we're going to get into much more detail on how to do it later. And it's sort of introducing us to concepts and then pointing us to where those concepts are going to play out later on.
Yep. And, you know, it is a couple of intro chapters before they really get into the meat of it, but this is still a useful chapter in its own right.
I'm still inspired.
Yeah. Well, and the effects for single card section that we're about to get to is quite interesting. It has a lot of the sense of Chronicles of Amber Trumps to me in a way.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with the Chronicles of Amber, the Trumps let the major named characters talk to each other by pulling each other's cards from Trump decks that have been made with powerful magic. This is not exactly that, but it's very much kind of treating cards as one-shot magic items that do a big, impressive thing.
This is this to me was very much them taking in one of the cool things from Madness of Gardmore Abbey and putting it in the fifth edition. Because that was a feature of Madness of Gardmore Abbey, is that you're finding the individual cards, and each of them are basically their own little minor magic item.
Yeah.
This is one of those things that I read and thought, I wish I could go back 5 years and run that Midgard campaign over again and let my players do things like using the individual cards as magic items rather than having them rush to assemble the deck so they could do something stupid with it.
Sure. Now, I did have one question going through all those individual card effects. They all do their thing like once a day. For example, the very first one is balance. As an action, you brandish the card at a creature that you can see within 30 feet of you. You drain its life force. The target must succeed at a con save or take 48 necrotic damage, and then you regain the number of hit points that they lose because there's a balance, right? And then they all end with, once this property is used, it can only be used, or it can't be used again until the next dawn. And that definitely seems to have become the standard phrasing of the once a day magic item. And it only just now occurred to me with reading through these, does this mean that as a DM, I can totally hose my players when they're in like Avernus or the Feywild where there is no dawn?
I want to say that Descent into Avernus might specifically have handling for, you know, there's no dawn here in magic items. I know that there's a rule somewhere for what do we do in worlds without dawn.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, the question I had about this, though, reading it, and I may have just missed it, was... they're pretty powerful, and with that regen of dawn thing, like, what level are is expected for these?
Yeah.
Because my first impression was like, oh, wait, it can bring back dailies. Yay.
But they're powerful dailies.
I mean, these aren't weak abilities.
Not at all. You're right that they are, you know, dailies and not, you know, once ever items. I didn't read closely and totally assumed. But Yeah, I mean, they're definitely really powerful stuff.
I mean, the comet does 12d6 damage.
Yeah.
And that's a once-a-day ability. Like, I'm just going to hit somebody with a comet for 12d6 damage once a day. That's, like...
Well, to be fair, not the key lets you cast knock.
Which is a first-level spell.
So it's all over the place.
Yeah.
But it is... Five uses of knock.
Oh, five uses is nothing. not nothing.
That's, you know, I guess we need a rogue in this party.
Right.
I mean, do you really run into five locks in a single turn?
I will if I have that card.
Well.
Everything is locked.
That's it. We're going to the keep.
But, I mean, they're pretty cool. You're right that there isn't a lot of guidance on, you know, how they should be treated in terms of rarity. Because collectively, the deck is an artifact. Individually, these sort of range from rare, maybe the upper end of uncommon, up through, that's definitely a very rare... arguably the low end of legendary.
Sure, but bear in mind that if you're running a campaign wherein you're collecting the cards, the individual cards mean that you are collecting 22 magic items that do not require attunement and are usable once a day to do.
Well, I think that you don't use this whole approach to the rules for collecting each individual card, because that would be a lot.
I mean, but that's what Gardmore Abbey did.
Fair enough.
But I don't think they were as powerful as this. I don't recall.
Well, and also you did have a limit on your magic item usage in fourth, right? We just had our episode on fourth edition. We're talking about magic items. There was a thing about magic items and milestones and how you could use daily effects.
Yeah.
I'm not looking it up right now, but there was a thing.
The other section of this is the idea of adding to the deck and what it would take, because they're basically implying, and the things they're doing later on in the book make it clear that, like, people have added new cards to the deck. According to the lore, Istis originally created the, 22 cards, and then over time, other people have added more cards to the deck. And when you add a card to the deck of many things, it appears like in instances of the deck throughout the planes, is sort of the implication, I think.
Yeah.
And they don't, I like that there's not like, here's the formula. Here's the you know, going back to other editions, here's the number of XP to spend, and here's how much money it's going to cost, and the items, the quest items you need to go onto. But it's more of just a handful of paragraphs of advice of how do you go about adding to the deck. And step one is you have to be a 17th level magic user with significant time on your hand. And so it's not like... it's not just that, oh, this is a thing I want to do to cement my legacy as a character, but it's a powerful character who's like, I'm going to really create an adventure for the DM to run us through so that I can solidify my legacy in the planes.
I do like, though, the story element of there potentially being gatherings of people that have added to the deck of many things. That is kind of a cool... to work into, you know, a storyline as a background.
Yeah, because there's the very last section of that discussion is, you know, when somebody creates a card, maybe reward them with some sort of boon, some sort of benefit for having created some, you know, an iconic card that goes into the deck of many things. And here are four ideas, and one of them is exclusive membership into the society of powerful magic users that have created cards for the deck of many things. And that's a fun little, like, you know, and I, you know, I'd probably give them, you might give them all four of them, right? You get your own little demi plan to hang out in, you're immortal, and that's why the everybody's sort of getting together all the time, because now you don't die.
I I don't want to sound like a broken record, but this reads exactly like Amber Wright's Traveling Between Shadows.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I've been reading Eric Wujek's Shadow Knight supplement for Amber Diceless, and sort of, yep, that sounds like a D&D interpretation of Shadow Knight to me. All right, that's awesome.
From a story standpoint, I hope that they never ever say that either Elminster nor Mordenkainen contributed a card, because I love the idea that both of them are these well-known wizards that have been to multiple planes of existence, and there's still this group that's like, oh, but you haven't made a card.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's
on one hand, yes. And I could, and in my head, that group would look down on Mordenkainen and Elminster because you're not part of the group. And Mordenkainen and Elminster both would respond with like, yeah, but like, who the fuck cares? Like, why did that matter? I'm busy doing important shit, you know?
Oh, but you know that someone in the Circle of Eight is like, yeah, Mordenkainen, he doesn't really apply himself.
Yeah. I feel like Bigby would make a card, though.
Yep.
Yeah.
Speaking of D&D characters that would make a card, I don't know if anybody listened to Critical or watched Critical Role all the way through campaign 2.
Not yet, but I'm in the middle of it now.
I have, yes.
There is a point where Jester is making tarot cards. And I can totally picture, you know, Jester being one of these people that at some point made something that contributed to the deck of many things, except that knowing Jester, I know what the card would be, and it wouldn't be safe for work.
Oh, no, it would not. I think that maybe Jester had a little chat with Matt. It was like, what if we just make the Jester card? Is that okay? Just the Jester. Okay.
Right on. All right. Any last thoughts on these two chapters? Man, two chapters at a time. We're gonna make 11 of these episodes.
Woof, buddy.
If it was almost only Christmas time, right, Brandis?
Yeah, that'd be about right. Just finish it with, you know, one whole episode on, you know, the book of card meanings, and
yep,
as you 12 days, job done.
All right. Well, unless anybody has any last thoughts on these two chapters, we'll be back to talk about chapter 3 and beyond. Maybe we can learn to talk more briefly. That's not going to happen. It's going to be 11 episodes. Never mind.
Yeah.
So maybe we could get up to 3 or 4 episodes.
This is absolutely your fault for inviting Jared and me.
Yeah, no.
This is true.
I knew what I was getting into. And honestly, when I thought about doing the episodes this way, you two immediately came to mind as ideal for this conversation. So,
I am flattered. We'll try to keep it on point.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go ahead and wrap up this episode then. I do want to thank our guest, Brandis. Where can people go to find you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky. I am at Brandis Stoddard at bsky.social. I write for tribality.com. My personal blog is brandisstoddard.com. And my Patreon is Brandis Stoddard.
And Jared, where should people go to find you?
Okay, so you can find some of the reviews I write on Gnome Stew. You can find the other reviews that I write on my personal blog, whatdoiknowjr.com. And also, if you like listening to podcasts, which I hope you do because you're listening to this one, I have a podcast with Ange from Gnome Stew called Thacko with Advantage. So look for that where fine podcasts are housed.
My only problem with the podcast, with your podcast, is Thacko. I prefer Thaco as a pronunciation, but yeah. All right. I also want to thank everyone who supports us by being patrons over at patreon.com/thetomeshow. That helps me pay the bills. Which is the goal, is I like having this hobby that's a lot of fun and I get to talk to cool people about cool things. But it doesn't cost me money. It just costs me time to do it. So, and everybody else gets to enjoy it too.
And if you would like to talk to us, you can send us email, thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can find us on various social media. I'm Sarah Dark Magic pretty much everywhere. That's Sarah with an H. And Jeff is Squatch, S-Q-U-A-C-H, at pretty much everywhere.
Everywhere that I choose to be anyway, yeah. Which, yeah. I at least have a presence in most of the places. I don't regularly check them unless somebody sends me something with a note and I get a notification. So. Anyway, that is episode 364, where we drew our first card from the deck of many things. In this episode of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.